Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello and welcome to another episode of Luke's English Podcast. In this episode, I'm going to interview my friend Mike Bruce about his recent teaching experience in Ghana in West Africa. Mike is an old friend and colleague of mine. He's originally from Scotland, although he doesn't have a particularly strong accent, and he has lived and worked in places all over the world. I've known him for about 13 years, and he was one of the first people I ever worked with as a language teacher in Japan. Mike has an amazing CV. He's taught in lots of countries all around the world. He's very highly qualified, and as well as teaching students of English as a second language, he also teaches teachers how to teach. So he's pretty much a Jedi master of English language teaching, in my opinion. Mike recently came back from a teaching mission in Ghana. And judging by the Facebook photos and statuses that I saw on the internet, it was quite an epic experience for him. I thought it would be interesting to talk about this experience on Luke's English Podcast. So my aim for this interview is to have a bit of a chat with Mike, just a bit of a chat, introduce him to my listeners, the Lepsters, the Lepans, the Lepians, the Lepanese, the Leplanders, the Lepish, the Lepaholics, to introduce him to you guys, and then to find out about his African teaching experience. If you go to teacherluke.co.uk and find the page for this episode, you will be able to see the questions and notes that I used during this interview, and you'll also be able to see a slideshow of some of Mike's pictures from his Ghana experience, so do check that out. Now then, it's time to call Mike on Skype, so here we go. Hi.
Hey, Luke. How are you? You all right?
Fine. You?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. I'm good. Good to see you again.
Good to see you too. Not too cold?
Well, you know, typical London. Nice grey, wet winter.
Yes.
But it's the only way to have a winter in London, I feel.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, I mean, if it was sunny and warm, you'd be disappointed, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. I know. It's like walking around in a big, you know, winter sweater in a hot country. It's kind of a, you know, it's disappointing.
Yeah, exactly. You expect it to be a bit cold and grey and miserable in London at this time of year.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. How's Paris?
It's pretty much exactly the same, although the sort of stereotype of Paris, that everyone seems to forget about the weather. But it's always the same as it is in London. But London always gets the bad reputation.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. It's almost entirely the same here.
But London's obviously worse, though. I mean, we have British weather, not French weather.
So exactly. it's
kind of like, I think it's sort of like a little bit classier over there, isn't it, the weather, really?
Yeah, that's so, right. It's just a higher class of rain.
Higher class of rain. Champagne, isn't it, really?
It's premium quality rain. Yeah, it basically rains champagne here in France, that's right.
Yeah, we don't have proper rain. That's a problem. We don't have a title for it,
That's true. I hear that you're having trouble with your central heating as well, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Yeah. So it's now been 48 hours with no central heating, no hot water. Sadly, the same thing happened almost exactly the same time last year with the same problem with the boiler. So my landlord has obviously paid a lot of attention to the problem. So I've already spoken to him, so hopefully it will be resolved very quickly. So we've got one more day of being very cold in the house, and then hopefully it will be resolved by Tuesday. So I'm hoping that's the way it's going to be.
Yes. Well, for my listeners who can't actually see you, Mike is actually he's wrapped up in a like full-on winter clothing. He's got a scarf on and everything. So that's just a picture for you, just in case you need, you know, to let your imagination sort of do some work there. Imagine Mike wrapped up in a scarf in an extremely cold London flat with no central heating in the middle of winter. Whereabouts are you in London? You're in sort of...
I live in North London in Archway. Okay. So it's sort of... it's about 10 minutes from work, really. I work in Highgate. Mm-hmm. So I walk to work most mornings. So it's, most mornings, every morning, I walk to work. So it's only about a 10, 15 minute walk for me. So it's a nice area, sort of like quite close to Crouch End, yeah. Which is quite a nice area, really, of London. Yeah. It's, when I first arrived in London in 2011, I was living down in Camden. I noticed kind of a scary connection between my bank account and leaving Camden.
Really?
And moving somewhere else.
What, Camden's expensive place to live then, is it?
Expensive, and I didn't have the discipline to not go out pretty much every single evening.
Right. So, lots of pubs.
No. Lots of pubs, too many pubs. I live very close to the main strip, so okay. I haven't been to Camden now in about a year and a half or so, because I think I... Did my time in Camden.
Right. And your bank account's a lot healthier now as a result.
Well, I wouldn't really want to say that.
Yeah, you're an English teacher like me. How healthy can the bank account be, really, in that position?
Not that healthy. No. All right. Sort of like, you know, yeah.
Now, Mike, recently on Facebook, I saw you uploading lots of photographs and lots of status updates about this incredible experience that you've had in Ghana teaching English over there. I'm going to ask you about that in a moment.
Okay.
Because it looks fascinating. And on Luke's English podcast, we always want to hear about stories like that, you know, experiences of traveling abroad. That's very interesting. Welcome onto the podcast, by the way.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. How does it feel to be on this award-winning download for Learners of English, Mike? How does it feel?
It feels absolutely amazing. I've always, you know, wanted to be involved in your career and seeing you reach the dizzying heights of EFL. And
well, actually, Mike, I think that you always have been sort of involved in my career because, you're one of the first people that I ever worked with as an English teacher
years
ago.
Yeah.
And also, as well as that, you're also someone who... You managed to get me my first job in a British Council-accredited school in London. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember that school.
What a wonderful school it was, too.
Oh, it was amazing. I was really happy to let you go in there.
yeah. Well, it was an experience. Yeah. It was an experience.
It was. Yeah.
I'm not going to name the school, but
no, we're not for legal reasons. No.
Just for my listeners, Mike worked in a school in London, which was it was British Council accredited, which is normally a good thing, but it wasn't exactly the greatest establishment to work for. He left for obvious reasons, and obviously when he left, he knew that they needed a teacher, so he thought, which idiot can I ask to work in this nightmare? And he thought of me. But anyway, in a way it was a good step, because it was my first British Council accredited school. That looks good on the CV. Also, Mike, you did the Delta, the diploma, before me.
I did mine in 2005. When were you?
You did yours in the year before me, then I did mine the year after. I just remember you talking about it to me, and even sort of like, you know, giving me a bit of a push, suggesting that I should do it too. And then I did do it the year after, and I got it as well. But first of all, how do we actually know each other? Do you remember, like, the first time?
I think we worked together. The first time I met you was in Zushi in Japan.
That's right.
Probably back in, I think it must have been, 2001.
End of 2001, beginning of 2002.
That's right, yeah, and I was just about to leave. I think I was moving the following year, I think you came across in, like, the September or so.
I was there in January. January 2002, and you left in like May 2002, I think.
That's right. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and I went down to Australia after that. But yeah, so we worked together for about nine months or so.
About half a year, I think.
Yeah,
We worked together in that tiny little teacher's room. In the little town of Zushi, just on the coast of Japan, there near Yokohama. What do you remember about that time? I mean, that was probably, was that your first teaching job as well?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I moved out to Japan in October 1999. That was my very first teaching experience, really, and ended up staying there for nearly just under 3 years, 2.5 years, I think I was out there in total. I'd never ever thought about teaching English before. Just kind of at a loss at the end of university, not knowing what to do. Someone said, "Oh, go to Japan." So I went, "Okay, I'm gonna go to Japan." And moved across there. So I think what I remember most is just like the group of friends that I sort of met there, that kind of mutual friends that we had as well. With John Graves. I know that you two used to sort of meet up and have your jam sessions together and things like this. I sort of remember our late night sort of farewell party and us going to an izakaya when my leaving party at something like 7 a.m. with John and his girlfriend at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
I do remember it being quite a comical sort of event. And
Obviously, at that time, we were both like a bit younger. We were in our mid-20s and stuff. It was a typically sort of crazy time. And Japan is a great place for going out at night and you know, drinking a few beers and all that sort of thing and getting into adventures and things. I remember, I don't know if I should mention this, but I remember some of the little situations that we ended up in. Do you remember, Mike, do you remember a character called the Drunken Gaijin? Do you remember that?
The drunken gaijin.
You don't know.
That's not me, was it? Was that something I did?
Yeah, something you did a few times.
Was that about falling over? I think it was falling down flights of stairs, wasn't it?
That's right.
I've forgotten about that.
You had a trick which you would do after you'd drunk enough beer, which was, you know, most of those nights that we went out and did things. You do this trick, you'd become the drunken gaijin. Just for anyone listening to this who doesn't know what a gaijin is, it's the Japanese word for a foreigner. So basically, it's like the drunken foreigner. And so Mike would just get quite drunk, you know, and we would all be having a good time. And then Mike would suddenly become this character called the Drunken Foreigner. And it would be just like this sort of irresponsible foreign guy breaking all of the social rules of etiquette that you get in Japan. And there are quite a few. It's a very ordered society and people tend to follow numerous unwritten social rules. And as a foreigner living in Japan, you become very aware of these things. They're like limitations on your daily life. You know, you've got to stand in the right place. You can't be too loud. Don't be confrontational in public, all that sort of thing. And I think probably what happens is the pressure of all those social limitations got a bit much. And after a few drinks, it had to come out somehow. And so Mike would do this this thing where he'd like fall down the stairs. It was amazing. It's like you were a stuntman, a brilliant stuntman. And you know the way stuntmen fall downstairs, they do it without hurting themselves. Well, Mike would kind of do this. He would just be walking down the stairs and he'd pretend to fall over and tumble down the stairs. And it would just be amazing to watch the reactions of all the Japanese people around. Most of the time, there were almost no reactions because they're too sort of, I don't know, they're too shy or too embarrassed to make a big deal out of it. So the more ridiculous you got, the more sort of reserved all the people around would get. And even to the point where you'd be like falling over right in front of people, like be like businessmen on the train platform and you'd walk past them and then fall over and just nothing, like total poker face from these guys. It was like a hilarious slapstick comedy routine for me. Anyway, that was a long time ago. These days, of course, you're far more professional.
Oh, absolutely. I've generally not tried to do that deliberately anymore. It still happens on occasion, but you know, it's not deliberate anymore.
These days, of course, you're known as being a sort of professional burgeoning English language teacher. traveling to places like Ghana to help train people to teach English, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so that's kind of what my role is now. So you sort of developed beyond the falling downstairs.
That's right. Now, talking about your CV, Mike, I don't think falling down the stairs is something that you would, you know, you'd put on the CV, but you have got quite an extensive CV, I think. You said you first got into teaching just out of university. You didn't really know what to do, just like many of us. How long have you been teaching now, then?
Now about 15 years. So it'd be 15 years in, in October, So 15 years now. So 1999 was when I started, and been doing it ever since. So it's been fun. It's been a whirlwind, really.
You've been to lots of different places, haven't you?
Yeah. Yes, I have. So I've worked in, I guess, in total now, 9 countries. So I started in Japan. I was there for about 2.5 years. And then from Japan, I went to Australia. And it was actually in Australia where I did my first teaching qualification, which was the CELTA, which is kind of a requirement, I think, as you know, for just entry level to become a teacher. And then from there, so I was there for about a year, then went to Taiwan for a year. Then came back to the UK, and that's when I worked at that wonderful institute somewhere in London. Then I went to St. Giles for the first time and did my diploma, my Delta, while I was there.
St. Giles,
yes. Yeah. And then I moved to Berlin, and that's where I trained to become a CELTA trainer. And I was there for about a year or so. Then I moved to the Netherlands. I was there for 4 years. Also working on teacher training and examining as well. And in between that time, I worked in Vietnam doing teacher training courses. I worked in the United States doing a teacher training course. And then I've also worked Ghana as well now. So about nine countries in total.
Japan, Australia, Taiwan, UK, Berlin, that's 5, Netherlands, 6, Vietnam, 7, USA, 8, Ghana, 9. Well done. You can count as well as well as teach English.
I know. I'm a multitasker.
I see. So not only are you CELTA qualified, Delta qualified, you're also a teacher of teachers. So you're like a Jedi master at this point.
I basically am. I am Obi-Wan.
You are, aren't you? You are Obi-Wan Kenobi. Brilliant. Yeah. You've even got the beard as well for it.
I do, I know. So I was trying to get into the Christmas spirit. So, although it has to, like, sadly, something that I have noticed in comparison to many years ago when I used to grow my beard. Now that I'm 36, I realize it's actually very white.
Yeah, you've got a bit of grey in there.
Yeah, I've been trying to convince myself it's blonde, but actually it's kind of like, you know, it's gone from like a nice sort of like grey to kind of like a silver, really? And it's gone, just given up on the silver and gone straight to white.
Silver fox.
Basically, yeah, that's what I like to consider myself as being. Okay. Not many women would agree with you on that, but, you know.
I don't know. I think that the ladies like a bit of grey in the beard. You know, a bit of salt and pepper, you know?
Exactly. I'm sort of looking for that, you know, that fatherly sort of figure, role model.
Girls
are obviously interested in.
Ladies out there, any girls listening to Luke's English podcast? I know there are many. If you like a slightly grizzled, experienced English teacher with, a bit of grey in the beard there, it shows his experience, his life experience.
Yeah, just think of a really, really sort of like ugly Jason Statham lookalike.
Yeah, Jason Statham, exactly, with a slightly silvery beard. That's the kind of thing we're looking at here, ladies.
Yeah.
Okay, so out of all these places that you've been to, Mike, which ones are particularly memorable for you? I mean, you must have had some interesting experiences all around the world.
I've always had a soft spot for Asia. So when I went back to Vietnam, I think that was quite amazing to go back there. But also, like, going back also gave me the opportunity to go and travel to Cambodia and have a look around other places. But I think Ghana, without a doubt, is probably, in terms of life-changing sort of situations, that was definitely... It was something I'd never... I think with Ghana, what was exciting about it was I had nothing to compare it to.
Right.
It was an experience that was unlike any other experience I've ever had. So I didn't know what to expect when I got there. Mm. But I think in terms of the effect that it had, in terms of not just professionally but personally, it was actually quite... quite strong. I think a lot of people talk about, you know, poverty and things, and it's certainly not, you know, the most impoverished country in Africa in comparison to other countries. But it's still, the standard of living is very low. We were based about 7 hours north of the capital city. As I've learned how to say it now, is Accra.
Accra.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we were 7 hours north of that. So when we arrived, we were picked up by a lady called Jill Norris, who works for a charity, which is in connection with an independent school in Tunbridge Wells, and it's called GEP, which is a Ghana Education Project.
Right.
And her charity is primarily to sort of like help raise education standards for Ghanaian girls.
Right.
And she's opened up an all-girls school over there. So she picked us up in Accra and drove us up to Nkwanta, where we were based for the 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And that was, about 6.5 hours, 7 hour car drive on very bumpy dirt roads.
Yeah.
Which was a bit sore on the old bottom after about 6.5 hours of bouncing around.
Of bouncing up and down on your bum. At that point, were you thinking, God, I hope this is worth it?
Yeah, it was pretty much like that. Okay. And it was pretty much, with the Nkwanta itself, the only way to sort of describe it is it's a town that's kind of been built on either side of basically, in all purposes, it's kind of like a motorway, but a dirt track, and that road goes all the way up and connects up to Togo and Burkina Faso.
Right.
So the town itself is about 15,000 people. They live on either side of this road, which is pretty much just red dust road.
Red dust.
Red dust. Yeah, the dust there is unbelievable. I would probably have to wash my clothes probably about 3 times a week.
Really.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. I had a nice pair of boots which I had taken with me, which kind of like a greyish color, and now they're just brown. It's totally stained by the dust.
I expect you've got lots of clothes that are still covered in dust. Is that right?
Yeah, get the dust out. Get it out.
I went to Indonesia this year, and we climbed up a mountain and we got covered in dust there. A couple of my t-shirts, just can't wear them again. I've washed them again and again. Can't get the dust out. They're just
nothing at all.
Yeah, they've just been dyed by the dust. And so, yeah, you too. But there's red dust. So red dust, a red dust kind of highway that connects the capital of Ghana all the way up through to the sort of northern neighboring countries. So this highway, but it's just dust basically. There's no asphalt or tarmac or anything. And so, a town with about 15,000 people just sort of sitting either side of this motorway, 7 hours north of the capital city.
Yeah.
So you're right out in the middle of nowhere, deep inside Ghana.
Yeah.
And so as far as I understand, you worked for this charity, the GEP, in order to,
The reason I went over there is the school I work for here in the UK is called St. Giles, and our school's divided into two sections. One section is a private language school, and the other side is the educational trust. And the trust is where we run things like Delta, TKT, ISELT, and CELTA, which I work on. So these are sort of like teaching qualifications, which, you know, teachers can do, and that's what we're involved in. And the other part that the trust is quite heavily involved in is overseas secondments in developing countries.
Mm.
So the trust runs things in Bangladesh, Ethiopia, Malawi, Kenya.
Right.
And this was the first year we'd done something in Ghana.
Right.
So my role was, last year I was working as acting head of teacher training, for St. Giles Highgate. And I was asked if I'd be involved in setting up this project. So I was a lead trainer which basically meant I was involved in designing the course, recruiting a trainer to go out with me to Ghana and run the project, and primarily be dealt with most of the communications with this lady called Jill in Ghana.
Right.
So our role was to go out and work sort of in, not so much teacher training, but more teacher development.
Okay. So you got like a team of teachers working in a school in this town, and you're like helping to develop their teaching skills and so on. Okay.
Basically, All right. So we'd go in 2 days a week. We sort of went in the first day we were there. Well, the first week we arrived was a little bit. It was very hard to know what was going to happen. When we arrived, there was a general strike going on, so none of the teachers were at school. Then there was a situation, sadly, with one of the senior sort of district supervisors was shot dead.
Really?
Yeah, and the Monday, we met him on the Monday, and he was shot dead in the Monday evening.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so that created a bit of tension. So, in the area,
do you know why he was shot?
I think it was all hearsay and rumours. Really, I think a lot of it was about because he was very anti-corruption, and I think he was trying to clamp down on various things. And I think it was something to do with that. Luckily, he wasn't tribal. If it had been tribal, then up in that region, there were two tribes where there has been history of tension between them. He was one particular tribe, and if it had been the case that it was tribal, then that could have led to quite a lot of problems. But it was kind of hard because when we arrived, and it took quite a lot of sort of liaising and myself and my colleague Simon having to be very proactive in trying to pin down teachers and get them to commit to, you know, they knew we were coming, but we it was in some ways having to ensure that they would actually go back, be at the schools.
Right.
Which sadly, as we discovered, was not always the case. So when I was saying about it being kind of life-changing, one of the things that for me was, I'm an educationalist at heart, and I think when you go out there and you kind of actually really begin to appreciate what it is that we have and actually begin to value education and the importance of education more than I used to.
What do we have then? I mean, if we compare what we have, let's say, in the UK compared to what they have in Ghana, what is the difference?
Well, in terms of we have generally very good facilities, and pretty much everything is at our fingertips. So things like, you know, we have, you know, you think about the language schools that where we've worked at, every single class has interactive whiteboards, all the students are guaranteed materials, just basic things like pens, paper.
Photocopiers,
absolutely. And when you get over there, in the schools where we were located, there was no electricity in the schools. There was no running water in the schools. The only sort of water that they had was kind of linked to a borehole. So this wasn't drinking water. It was just generally used for, like, you know, pouring down to clean toilets and things. So the toilets were, for example, in the schools with, you know, 300 kids in these schools, and they share these sort of, like, basically pits, basically.
Just a hole in the ground.
Basically, that's all it is, which I luckily didn't have to use.
you managed to avoid the hole in the ground.
I managed to control myself quite well.
You mean you just held on all day?
I held on all day until I got back to my nice Western toilet.
So you actually had a Western toilet in your accommodation?
Yeah, we had quite a nice little guest house. I wouldn't say it was, you know, there wasn't like a flash or anything. It was just like a clean bedroom and a shower and a toilet, really. That's all we needed, really. Luxury, that was basically it.
Yes.
So, but in terms of the facilities, so I'd said pretty much, you know, what we have here in the UK. Kids there, they generally not. They come to schools just in their uniforms, really. They'd share maybe one course book between four. Most of the kids didn't have pens or paper.
Really?
A lot of the time, the kindergarten that I went in to see, the children would practice writing on the floor of the classroom, actually on the concrete floor, just using chalk.
Really? Just chalk on the floor? Wow.
Chalk on the floor, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
And the other thing I think that kind of struck me was, I think, I'm not trying to say this is, you know, indicative of, like, Africa or anything like that, so I don't want it to be, you know, perceived that it's not like a judgment on Africa or anything,
but... You're not making a general statement about Africa, but one...
No, but the teachers, I think that's the aspect which I found quite hard to sort of understand, was when you have, like, 300 children, a lot of them walking up to 5 kilometers to school each day. So that's not just 5 kilometers in total, that's 5 kilometers to school, 5 kilometers home from school.
Yeah, yeah.
36 degree, you know, Celsius.
Yeah. So these kids really want to learn. They're prepared to walk in 38 degrees Celsius, 5 kilometers to get to the school in the first place. So they're seriously motivated to learn.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the teachers
wouldn't be there.
Teachers just wouldn't come.
Yeah, they wouldn't come, or they would turn up late, or they would. So the school day was supposed to go from 8:10 until 2:00, and we'd see teachers arriving at 10:00, teachers leaving before 2:00, classes with maybe about 30 to 40 children in them with no teacher.
Right.
But the kids were so bright and so autonomous, and they would just be sat in the classrooms diligently working by themselves, teaching each other. And one of these kids are so bright, they can see how important education is. That education there is a way out, it's a way of getting a better future. They can see that at that age, you know, 6 or 7 year olds, the maturity levels of these kids is very different to a 6 or 7 year old here in the UK. These kids, you know, will be working in market stalls, or be going to the farms on the weekend, carrying loads of up to 10 kilos on their heads to market. And when they go to school, they want to learn. So if there was a teacher there, what would happen would be a teacher would be teaching their class, and all the other students, they would all be sitting at the windows, leaning in, or getting to the doorway of the class, because there was a lesson going on. They want to learn. They want to, you know, the passion that they had was unbelievable.
Wow. It makes me think about some of my students in some of my classes.
Yeah.
Who you know, I'm teaching them, I'm doing my best, and I look around the class and I think, how many of you are just waiting till the end of this class? I find that very, very sad. It just shows that it's about the attitude of the students, and sometimes, you know, and myself included, I'm sure, sometimes we take so many things for granted. That you know, we take for granted the fact that we have education and facilities and our quality of life is pretty good. But these kids, they're so desperate for some way to improve their situation that education for them becomes vital. And 6 or 7 year old kids are fully aware of this, and they're like leaning into the window of another class just to be able to listen to some of the content that's going on. Amazing. That must have been incredible to see as a teacher. Did you actually teach any English classes while you were there?
Yeah, we did. We stepped in a couple of times and taught some classes because the teachers weren't there, so we stepped in and taught the classes.
How was it?
Oh, amazing. Absolutely amazing. One thing that was kind of, because the in Ghana, English is one of the official languages. Mm. And it was really interesting, because we'd go in and I'd be talking to the kids, because they understood, their English is pretty good. But I'd be talking, but they wouldn't understand my accent at all.
Yeah.
And then a Ghanaian teacher would repeat exactly what I said, but with their accent, and the kids would go like, oh, right, okay, okay, I understand now.
Yeah.
So that was quite hard, but then they thought, you know, from your experience, you know, as well from teaching, that students, they'll tune into your accent quite quickly.
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of what happened. But they were just very smart, very diligent, very, you know, hardworking. And just basically, they'll just lap everything up. They just want to get knowledge. They want to be given an opportunity to learn. And that was amazing. From a teaching point of view, one of the things in terms of resources that we know, so when we first got there, You know, teaching here in London, you know, or doing teacher training, we can have photocopy machines, we have our IWBs, interactive whiteboards to make our lessons really interesting and to, you know, to give them a bit of oomph in some ways, to sort of like the presentation or handouts and photocopies.
Yeah. To give it that sort of nice edge. Like sometimes, you know, you pay a lot of attention to just the way in which the page is organized and if it's color or black and white, or if you like, have to, like use glue to glue something onto another photocopy, you have to make sure it's arranged in exactly the perfect way and that every letter is, you know, visible and so on. So, you know, all these like fine little details and things, but over there, they're just, if they have paper, they're lucky. Yeah,
basically. So we sort of ended up having to redesign our whole. So in the afternoons we do workshops for the teachers, and we ended up having to go back to square one, just scrap everything and redo things. So basically, we went down to the photocopy office one day. There was one place which had a photocopy machine, which cost a fortune to get things printed off. Took a very long time as well, because in the Kwanta there were lots of power cuts. Basically, they just turned off the power to the region because they've had their share of electricity for that week, so they turn off the electricity.
On Thursday, it's like, well, you've had all your electricity, that's it. Turn it off.
It was unbelievable. So we ended up, you know, we're making these photocopies, but then it was a realization of, well, we need to actually deliver our sessions based on the resources which they have available, because there's no point in going and making all these like beautiful photocopies if that's something that they don't have access to, or they don't have the money to do that. So in the end, we just took the ideas from our, you know, our notes that we usually give people, and we just use the blackboard and chalk, and then we'd write everything up, and that's how we'd lead our sessions doing that.
So back to basics.
Absolutely. And it is surprising, and it is one of those things just in terms of teaching, and I sort of think, you know, it's interesting what you said, you know, that we want to give a bit of edge and things to our lessons. And sometimes, you know, I've noticed that in teacher training as well, that sometimes teachers sometimes spend a little bit too long on thinking of how to make, you know, their lesson look good.
Right.
And I think that's sometimes a question that made me question quite a lot of things that I would, you know, in terms of my own teaching, I just began to sort of think, well, how much time am I spending on the presentations versus the content?
Right.
And I think if you're sacrificing time on the content of your lesson, then that's not a good use of time.
Yes.
And I saw some very effective lessons just basically using the blackboard and chalk and the course book. And I think that's something I'm going to try to encourage at my school, is that maybe that we have one day a week where teachers don't use the internet. We don't use handouts. We don't use supplementary, but take the book, and because a lot about, you know, the course book is, it's generally how the teacher sort of sets it up, and it's the ideas that the teacher has. And I think using, you know, the resources that we have at our fingertips, and I think maybe get us to go back and work on basics, really.
Yeah. You know? I wonder, from my students or my listeners, I'm sure many of my listeners have spent time learning English in language schools. I wonder what they think. So, listeners, what do you think? How do you feel about the presentation of like materials which are given to you by your teachers, about the technology which is used in the classroom? How do you feel about, for example, the way the content is presented and the actual content of the lesson? Does it matter to you, for example, if your photocopies look perfect or not? What do you think about presentation versus content in terms of material and technology? I'd like to know. Leave your comments, teacherluke.co.uk. Find the page for this episode. Boom, Bob's your uncle. Leave us a comment. It sounds like it was a fascinating experience for you as a teacher, because you learnt things about going back to basics, and you realised that just sometimes the simple approach is best. I think it's known as the dogma approach, right? Which is like just teaching without any without any of the technology, basically, just really simple teaching, just using the resources that are available there, and then using the students as a resource and making it very direct and straightforward and simple. I wonder also, though, about just the general experience as a person. I mean, how was it in terms of it being life-changing? I think you probably mentioned that it's about just realizing what we have and the things we take for granted and what they have. I'm curious as to the first impressions that you had. When you were going, what did you expect, first of all?
To be honest, that was kind of a difficult question, actually. Because to be honest, I didn't know what to expect. I had nothing to compare it to. I mean, obviously with the whole issue with Ebola, that was obviously a concern.
Right.
I think that was something that I was concerned about most, was either getting something like malaria or picking up some kind of bug, which a lot of people, obviously, like, because we're not used to the sort of climate in terms of the environment where we're going in Africa, especially coming from Western Europe, then we can pick things up quite easily.
Tropical diseases and stuff like that. Yes. You mentioned Ebola there, but it wasn't really a threat to you, was it, in Ghana? Because they don't have any cases of Ebola there, I think.
No, that's right. Ghana's a very safe country in terms of the risk to risk from Ebola. There aren't any cases in Ghana.
Yeah.
Things which could be an issue were things like cholera, which is there is a bit of an epidemic going on at the moment in the capital. Malaria, where we were located, malaria was rife, basically.
Loads of malaria. Did you get bitten by mosquitoes out there?
I got bitten all the time. My legs attract mosquitoes.
Your beautiful legs.
My beautiful white legs, Luke. You remember those? I just got bitten all the time. But I was on antimalarials, and I was using, even though I was using very strong DEET, which is an insect repellent, they still bit me.
Right.
Every evening I sort of wake up in bed under my mosquito net, scratching my feet. It was just very uncomfortable.
Did you take Malarone, anti-malarial? Malarone.
That's what I took. Yeah.
Did you get any side effects from Malarone?
No. I think there's one. I forgot the name.
Larium, I think.
Larium. Yeah, I think that's the one that makes people go a little bit psychotic. Unfortunately, my psychosis, I couldn't blame on the anti-malarials.
Right, it's just your normal psychosis.
It's just my normal psychosis.
I took Malarone this summer, I have to say that it gave me very weird dreams every night. I often dream, but I had particularly strong dreams on the Malarone. Really, really vivid. In fact, to be honest, one night I dreamt that I was... This is really weird. I've got lots of Russian listeners to my podcast. I don't know why this appeared in my dream, but I dreamt that I was being attacked by a Russian soldier. This really big Russian soldier grabbed me, and he was like squeezing me, and I tried to fight back, and I tried to like push him in the face. You know those dreams where you're trying to punch someone and you can't do it?
Yeah.
You know that? I had one of those dreams, and I was like, push this guy away. And I woke up because I pushed my girlfriend in the bed next to me. I shoved her in the arm, and she woke me up like, hey, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, I'm really sorry. I was fighting against a Russian soldier. And she's like, what are you talking about? Go back to sleep. So obviously I blamed it on the Malarone. Like, it wasn't me. It was the Malarone, I promise. Okay, but you didn't really have any bad experiences.
No, I was actually health wise was absolutely fine.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
Didn't have any problems all
right.
at all.
Your colleague picked up the malaria though, right?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he got it. The thing about malaria is that there's a 7-day incubation period, so you could literally just get, you know, bitten while we're waiting at the airport, and then, you know, 7 days later you get the symptoms. The thing that's also kind of, then going back to, you know, the question you had about life changing was one of the differences over there is like, you know, they live with malaria. Everyone's, you know, had malaria a lot of time. So basically, Ghanaians, they just get on with it. You know, you see them walking around looking tired, and a lot of them have got malaria, and they just go down the pharmacy, get a drug. You know, they go through like 3 days of feeling pretty bad, but they feel pretty bad, but they go to work, they continue it, because with malaria it's not contagious, you can't pass it on. But over here, for example, it's, you know, my colleague went down to the hospital, they tested him for malaria, and next thing he's raced off to the tropical medicine medical university or something like that, and put on these like amazing drugs, put in, you know, amazing facilities. And and sometimes it just sort of like I think it's the hardiness of the Africans that really got me, you know. It was like
resilience.
Yeah, the resilience was unbelievable. You know, when you see, you know, I went to this small little town called Chiari, which is located in the mountains. So it took about, I think it was a 3-hour walk up to the top. And at the top, there was a little isolate community where they speak their own language. So you have to go with a guide who speaks that language.
Yeah.
The guide we went with is originally from this area.
Right.
And when we got there, we had to meet all of the village elders to be welcomed and be given permission to come into their town.
Right.
So we went up into this little local community, and the thing is that these paths, like, you know, they're up these steep mountainsides, and we'd see young girls all the way up to elderly women carrying loads of, it must have been, the loads on their heads must be, some of them be like 20 kilograms of weight on their heads.
Wow.
And they'd be walking up and down the mountainside, walking the 10 kilometers to the market and walking home again. And the 10 kilometers walking in that heat, they leave around about 5 in the morning to get there for about 10 o'clock, and then they'll, once been to the market, then they'll come back again. And you walk past these people, and not every single person we walk past would say to us, "You are welcome." That was a Ghanaian term, "You are welcome," meaning welcome to our, you know, our country, welcome, you know. And every single person we met, there was always a smile on the face. No one complained. No one was saying like, "Oh, this is hard. Oh, my life is difficult. Oh, I," you know. And it just made me sort of think about, you know, in terms of like illness, in terms of things like this, you know, when I got back, you know, and then I had a slight cold, and I really felt like taking the day off from work, and I just started like thinking about these people, and I think that, you know, they don't have that luxury. They get on with it. They go, "Oh, whatever, I've got malaria, I'm still going to go to work." And I was thinking, I've got a head cold. So I just thought, you know, the comparison, it was just unbelievable. But then also, like, thinking about the students and the attitudes of students. So, you know, when I'm as a teacher, and I just began to think about my students who, you know, they live only about a 20-minute walk away from the school, and they're late for class, or they don't come to class, and the next day they tell you, "Oh, I was really sleepy, I was tired." And I just sort of think, you know, I'm not trying to say that, but it did make me sort of question sort of things which I've seen in the class, but also made me question things about my own lifestyle and things which I do. So so in that way, it was eye-opening.
That's that thing you said about the what did you say about the students who have excuses, like they say they say things like, "Oh yeah, I was feeling a bit sleepy," or "the bus was late," or something. It's just not good enough, isn't it? I mean, they're blatantly excuses. I remember I had one student who had been in national service. Like, he was a soldier. He'd been in the army for 2 years or something, and he missed a class one day. And he came in. I said, "Why didn't you come to class yesterday?" He said, "Oh, I had like a really bad stomach. I was feeling really bad." I was like, "Dude, you're a soldier. You're a hardened military-trained killing machine, and you had a little bit of a stomach ache, so you couldn't come to your English class." I mean, it's really pathetic. It really is. So these, yeah, I can see how that really sort of opened your eyes, definitely. How did you feel completely out of place? Because I imagine you in Ghana, like, I mean, like, what? First of all, what do you look like, Mike? You mentioned before you look like Jason Statham. Tell us a little bit more about your appearance and how you felt in terms of an outsider. In this place.
Okay. For all you lovely ladies out there, here's my description for my. So I have basically I have no hair. I have a shaved head. There's only one way of putting it, really, isn't it, Luke? I could say, like,
basically,
you know...
That's it. I'm not going to beat around the bush. Let's just get straight down to it. There is no hair on my head. You got hair on your face.
I do. Unfortunately, it's the only place it sort of seems to grow at the moment. But yeah, so anyway, I'm...
Some ladies like a bald bloke.
They do, yes. I heard
somewhere I read on Facebook or something the other day, like, you know, 10 reasons why bald men make good lovers. And to be honest, Mike, the first point on that list was because they look like...
they look like Jason.
I'm not sure I take the article was supposed to be taken seriously, because the first point was that you look like a big cock. That was the first point. I don't know if it was a serious article, to be honest. Anyway, how did you feel looking like a big cock
in Ghana.
Jason Statham out there in Ghana?
Well, you obviously there's not much you can get away with, because pretty much we're the only four white people in the entire place.
You couldn't do the drunken gaijin then?
No, because they'd know it was me. but no, it was more that the fascination of, like, especially the young kids, they just kind of stare. The name for you is called a Bruni. I mean, you mentioned before about Gaijin, but over there is a Bruni, which means a white man. So everywhere you'd walk, we'd be like, a Bruni. And I think the one day we walked into this school, a different school, not the one that we were going into work at, but we visited another school, and we just happened to walk through, like, the playground, and probably about 250 kids got up and ran out of their classes and just came running across and just surrounded us, and just, like, pulling at us and touching and shaking your hand, and wow. You know, it was amazing. They were just wonderful, and then we ended up chasing them around the playground, and they thought it was the funniest thing in the world. I think one of the shocks was we met a lovely guy and his family. He's a guy called Emmanuel and his lovely wife Diane. We went around to his house, and I met his young son and his little daughter. His son was hysterical. He was just a wonderful, wonderful kid.
Yeah.
And his daughter, who's only 4 months old, and every time it seemed to be with me, not with my colleague, but I'd walk in and they'd be holding her, and she'd slowly sort of turn and just look at me, and then you could just see her face crimple up, and she'd just start crying her eyes out.
But it's so terrifying, Mike.
It was every single time I went there, and I could, you know, she'd stop crying, you know, mum and dad, like, it's okay, and then they'd turn her around and she'd see me again. It was like, oh my god, he's still here.
Oh my god.
That was like one of those moments which is quite funny. But overall, I mean, Ghanaian people are so welcoming. I mean, it's unbelievable. Mm. Just everywhere you went, you know, people were helpful and supportive. I mean, I met this lots of times, you know, people, they ask for your phone number and things like this, so give our phone number. And sometimes, you know, at the back of your mind, thinking, is there a reason for this? Anyway, I was off work on Wednesday last week, and I was at home, and my phone rang, and so I picked it up. And it was one of the Ghanaian guys. I just happened to meet in a bar when I was having a beer one night, just chatting to him.
Yeah.
And he called me up, and he said, oh, I tried to call you on your Ghanaian number, but it's not working anymore, and so I thought, call you in the UK. And he reminded me who he was, and he just said, I told you I wanted to call you and greet you, and I'm just calling to say hello. And I was like, wow, okay, thank you for calling. And
that's really nice.
And it was wonderful, and it was but they're just generally such a laid back group of individuals. They're very easygoing, but very supportive of one another, very helpful. I would highly recommend the country to anyone if you have an opportunity to go there. Obviously, the capital's like any capital, so it is very big, polluted and things like this. But you have the opportunity to go out into the countryside and or even to go and volunteer somewhere, then I would highly recommend it.
Was that the GEP that you mentioned before?
That's right,
that a
yeah.
Good, organization that people should maybe find out about if they want to go and volunteer. Can they do it through that organization?
Yeah. You can volunteer through that organization to teach at the school there. You'd have to go to the if you go onto the Ghana Education Project and have a look what the requirements are for volunteering. There were two young German girls that we met who were volunteering for a year, and yeah, they were loving the opportunity to be out there and things like that. And I'd highly recommend it. But then there are other organizations. There were lots of charities and things out there. I mean, one of the things I would probably say to any of your listeners, you know, if you sometimes having, you know, just having money and just donating money, it's sometimes just kind of, you know, while we're sort of giving the money, sometimes it's, you don't necessarily know where that money's going to go. But just, if you ever have the opportunity, just even if it's just for like a week, to go and volunteer in a school or in an orphanage or in a hospital or anything like that, that 1 week probably carries more value than just putting some money in the post, actually.
Yes.
So I'd highly recommend anyone, if you ever have an opportunity to do something like that, go and do it. So, I mean, I'm looking forward to going back. I'll probably be going back to Ghana towards the end of next year. But in the meantime, hopefully going out to a couple more places in Africa next year to work as well.
Yeah, really.
So, I want to go back to Africa. It was very hard coming home, actually. And
really?
It was very, very hard coming home. So I could see that it was an area in terms of my profession where I want to be more involved. I sort of move away from what I'm doing at the moment and be more involved in maybe potentially in the future. I think working for an NGO with something like that would be something that I would love to do.
Yeah, well, great. I think it's a really good move. Excellent. Thanks so much for telling us all about the experience.
No problem at all.
It's really interesting and fascinating.
Good.
So great. Okay, are you at work tomorrow morning?
Yes, I am, and then I'm on holiday for 4 days before Christmas. So
you got 4 days off, and then you've got your Christmas holidays.
No, I've got 4 days off, then I go back to work for a week. So I found out that I had 4 paid holidays that I had to take, otherwise I'll lose them. So, because they're not carried over. So, I've got 4 days off, so I'm just going to go around lots of galleries and museums. Well, hopefully have to fortunately give up one of my days for the to sort out the boiler in my house. And then then I want to go and explore some of the galleries and museums in London, which I sort of not gone to. So, that's my plan.
Yeah, there's so many great things to do in London that you can kind of take them for granted. Like my students, when I taught in London, they would always be very surprised when I hadn't been to a place. You know, they would say, "Oh, what's the Greenwich Observatory like?" And I'd say, "I don't know, I've never been." They'd be like, "What? You've never been? But you live in London." You don't realise that when people live there, there's sort of two types of London. There's the London for the people who live there, and they just go to work every day. And when they're not at work, they just stay at home in their little part of London, generally. And then there's the tourists who are there for, like, you know, 2, 3, or 4 weeks, and they see as much stuff as they can every single day. So, all right, so you're going to be a bit of a tourist in
London. Yeah, going to be a bit of a tourist for 4 days. Yeah, absolutely. I'm doing basically anything that involves no money is what I'll be doing.
Right. Okay. Great. Thanks for being on the podcast.
No problem.
Do you have anything else to say to the people of the world?
Keep it real, kids. Keep it real.
Okay. Respect.
Respect for you, man.
Okay. Cheers. Speak to you again soon, Mike.
Okay. Speak to you later, mate. Bye.
Nice one. Bye for now. Bye. So that was my conversation with Mike Bruce about his epic teaching experience in Ghana. I found that really interesting. I hope that you did too. As ever, I'm always interested in reading your responses to my episodes. So if you've got something to say, do go to teacherluke.co.uk, find the page for this episode, leave your comments below. I'd like to know what you thought about that experience and if you've had any other similar experiences yourselves. Enter the conversation. Please do leave your comments on the webpage. Also, go to the page for this episode and you'll be able to see a slideshow of photographs that will give you a good idea of what it looked like over there as well. So that's basically it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening to Luke's English Podcast. More episodes will be uploaded in the near future, but for now, it's just time for me to say goodbye. Bye, bye, bye. Thanks again for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.